Okay, folks, back to Ecclesiastes. Now, I don't know how you got on with those questions, but you've at least had a chance to have a quick look at some of the content of this book. I think it has to be said, it's not an easy book to read. It doesn't have any clear structure in terms of argument. It doesn't appear to be sort of going anywhere. It's very repetitious. It picks one thing up, leaves it down for a chapter or two, picks it up again for another couple of verses, etc. Sometimes the detail is very hard to understand. The phrases are not clear. And it's a book that I think has, because of its lack of clarity, has had many interpretations put on it. What sort of book is this? Who's writing? What's he writing it for? Let me just run through you some examples of the ways that people have looked at this book. Some people have looked at this book as being a personal spiritual pilgrimage. This is one man's personal quest for meaning. Starts as a pagan at the beginning, not being able to see any meaning in the world, ends up as a believer at the end, saying the fear of what you need to do is fear God. The trouble about that kind of argument is that actually the meaningless verdict comes all the way through the book, right to the last chapter. So that doesn't quite work. One variant on that is that people have said that this is the story of the repentant king. This really is Solomon, after his rebellion against God, looking back on the years, the time that he wasted, spent in futility, because he wasn't acknowledging God, as he ought to have been doing. Perhaps the most immediately attractive to us, I would think, is that this book is a critique of living life without God. That's essentially the line that Kidner takes, although he has some variations on that. And that's a very attractive view, isn't it? This is a book aimed at the secularist, the person who has no time for God. And the point of it, therefore, is to show such a person what a meaningless life it is if you leave God out of the equation. Well, it has to be said that undoubtedly this book has usefulness in that kind of exercise. And there are things that we can learn which will help us speak to those who are not Christian and point out just how meaningless life is without God. That's a valid use of this book, and we'll be looking at that a bit later in the day in our third session. But God is never really out of view in this book. He's always got God in the back of his mind, at least. Look at chapter 1, verse 13. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that's done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. He thinks about God even as he thinks of the confusion, the meaninglessness. Perhaps more significant than that, things are the way they are, he says, because of God's activity. Look on from 1:13. I've seen the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. There are some things that are just beyond straightening out. I mean, we all know that sort of situation, don't we? There are situations that despite our best efforts and our sincerest prayers and our hardest work will not turn out right, whichever way they turn out. Some things are so messy that they'll be messy. They're not able to be cleared up. But look on to chapter 7. Where he again picks up that idea of things being twisted, made crooked. 7:13. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy, but when times are bad, consider God has made the one as well as the other. You see, in this book, despite the meaninglessness, the confusion of everything that he sees, behind the scenes, as it were, he sees the positive activity of God. God has made it that way. God has made it crooked. God has made it twisted. It might well be appropriate to say that God is the author of the verdict. It's God who makes it meaningless. It's because of God's activity that it is meaningless. He's not leaving God out of the equation. In fact, God is right in there all the time. The godly man, perceiving what God is doing, says, things are meaningless. Now, there's no doubt that he does sometimes put himself in the shoes of the ungodly person, or of the person who hasn't got the right view of God. But basically, he's a godly person. And God is always in his thinking. Why then is this book here? What's it doing? What's the purpose of it? Well, what does he examine? Did anybody come up with any answers? What are the questions that he asks of the way things are? Just sing out, anybody. Why bother working? Yep. Anything else? Why bother studying? Why bother doing anything, in fact? Why bother doing anything? Just look at 1:3. What does man gain from all his labour at which he toils? What's the point of all the things that people do? Look at 1:13. I devoted myself to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. All the things that happen, all the things that are done. It's great to know you have support, isn't it? He looks at all the things that are done in the world and he says, what's going on? What's the point of it all? What's the point of all this stuff, all these things that are happening? An important phrase that he uses is, under the sun. Did anybody notice that? Examining all the things that are done under the sun. Now we'll pick up the significance of that phrase a little bit later on. And his main question seems to be, what gain is there? What's the point? What's the profit? It's a financial sort of word. You know, if with my investment of all the labour that I make, that I do, what comes out at the other end? Where does it all end up? To which his conclusion is, meaningless. There doesn't seem to be a point to anything that's done. Now just note, while we're doing this, that wisdom is always close at hand in his arguments. Look again at 1:13. Do you see what he says? It's not just that he's looking at the world, but he's looking at the world from the perspective of the wise man. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that's done under the sun, all that's done under heaven. He puts himself fairly and squarely, as we said before, in the shoes of Solomon, the archetypal wise man. Look, for instance, at what he says in chapter 2, verse 4 following. Undertaking great projects, made reservoirs, bought slaves, owned more flocks than anybody before, gathered silver and gold for myself, acquired men and women, singers, a harem, had everything, far greater than anybody in Jerusalem before me. He's echoing exactly the picture of Solomon that's given in the beginning of 1 Kings. He says that he's wiser than anybody who's ruled over Jerusalem before, 1:16. He puts himself in the shoes of Solomon, as it were. He is the wise man. This is a person who is looking at from the perspective of godly wisdom on the world and asking, what's the point of it all? Where's it going? What's worth doing? So look at chapter 2, verse 3. I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My mind still guiding me with wisdom. You know, he gets to alcohol and he says, I'm still a wise man. It's quite remarkable, really. Chapter 2, verse 9. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I was still looking at it from the perspective of the wise man. Verse 11 of chapter 2, he says, I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom. Sorry, that's not what I want. That's verse 12. Verse 11 of chapter 2. When I surveyed all that my hands had done, in brackets, from the perspective of a wise man, it seemed like a complete waste of time. What had I achieved? What was worth doing? And so he asks the inevitable question, which is, anybody? Exactly. Read the page. What is the point in being wise? What is the point in being a wise man? If even the wise man can't see what the point of anything is. Now look at the way he investigates that. Verse 12 of chapter 2. I turn my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. Verse 13. I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in the back of his head, while the fool walks in darkness. Obvious, really. But the same fate overtakes them both. In other words, better being wise, because at least you see what's going to happen to you, but everybody goes the same way in the end. What is the point in being wise? I don't know if anybody here is a devotee of those late night television junk thrillers. You know, the sort of thing it's a really complete waste of time to watch. But there's always a scene in one of those a bit like this. Somebody is in the kitchen, usually female, and there's a noise in the house. And she picks up the most enormous carving knife you've ever seen, which just happens to be lying there, and ventures out into the house without turning the lights on. And you think to yourself, everybody knows there's a psycho killer out there. She ought to know there's a psycho killer out there because she also watches the television. Why does she venture out in the darkness? Because you know what's going to happen, don't you? Well, the preacher's answer to that, the teacher's answer to that would be, well, doesn't matter whether she turns the lights on or not. The psycho killer out there is massive, and he's a huge chopper. And even if you turn the lights on, you won't escape. There's no value whatsoever in knowing what's going to happen. It's going to happen. That's the argument that he's putting forward here. The central question here is not just what's the point in anything, but what's the point in being wise? Because the same things happen to wise people as happen to foolish people. You see, wisdom is a very useful thing according to the wisdom writers. It really is genuinely useful. Look, for instance, at Proverbs chapter 6. Verse 6. Again, the wise man learning from the observable world. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler. Nobody has to get it to do anything. Yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit, and scarcity like an armed man. In other words, you ought to be able to learn from the way things work. Look at an ant. It works. It's a good thing to do. If you don't work, that will not be a good thing to do. You're supposed to learn from the way things are, say the wisdom writers. It's worth being wise. It's no good just having the big picture. You need to earth godliness in reality. Genuine wisdom keeps you in touch with reality. It makes you wise. It makes you live a godly life in the here and now. It keeps you human. But there's a danger with wisdom. There's a danger with it. You see, you can focus so much on what to do in the here and now, and in the right thing to do now, and in the wrong thing to do now, that even without forgetting God, you forget the big picture. You take your eyes off it. Now, let me turn you to another verse in Proverbs. Look, for example, at Proverbs chapter 20, verse 17. And we'll see how this might happen, this forgetting. Again, one of these brilliant little pictures. Food gained by fraud tastes sweet to a man, but he ends up with a mouthful of gravel. It's very graphic, isn't it? The picture is that if you get things by fraud, they'll not turn out nicely in the end. And that, we can all see that is the way things work, isn't it? But if you change it from being a proverbial saying, this is the sort of thing that happens if you are fraudulent, to a general rule, the fraud always goes wrong in the end. That would be wrong, wouldn't it? Because it doesn't always work like that. Sometimes food gained by fraud continues to taste sweet for a long time. Sometimes for the whole of life. The frauds are not always caught out, are they? One of the dangers in wisdom is that you can turn it from proverbial sayings into hard and fast rules of the way things happen. And if you do that, the danger is that you can turn the way God works into hard and fast rules about the way things happen from wisdom. And if you do that, you can forget that God's purpose is not just the living of a godly life now. God's purpose, as we saw earlier on, is the restoring of the whole created order to where it ought to be. Wisdom is to do with living life in a disordered world. God's purposes are to do with putting the disorder right. And the danger with wisdom is that you focus so much on the world now that you somehow forget about the big purpose. And if you do that, what happens is that everything has to work out in the here and now, if God is there. If God is there and is just, then we'll have to see justice in the here and now. We'll have to see reasons now. And that is the danger of wisdom, or the potential danger of it. It's not dangerous if you get it right, but it can go wrong. You see, we have not yet arrived. We are on the way somewhere. Even though at the time of Solomon, when wisdom explodes, it looks as though we have arrived, we've not arrived. And we mustn't think that we have. The danger in wisdom then is that wisdom is vital for living a godly life in a disordered creation. Vital. Otherwise you won't be human. But it can take your eye off God's ultimate purposes, and it can make you think that you ought to see meaning in the here and now. And that is its great danger. Now let's just see what the teacher does with meaning in the here and now. What's his method over the page? You'll notice that he focuses often on this little phrase, under the sun. Life under the sun. What does he mean? Well, I don't think it means, as some commentators say, life without God. Life leaving God out of the picture. It means rather life as we can see it in the world we live in. What we can see. The world that we can experience. And what the teacher does is to point out the inadequacy of a worldview which takes into account only what we can see and observe. Only the world as we know it. Now, of course, that can be life without God, can't it? Plenty of people live life without reference to God, and their only point of reference is the world that they can see. But it can be life expecting all of God's answers to be found in the observable world, which they won't be. Now, there are examples of that that I can think of. Let me give you one, practically, of how people expect to see answers in the here and now. A woman in our church, who's been a Christian now for many years, I heard her give a testimony recently, and she said that for a long time before she really became a Christian, she read the Bible. She was a devoted Bible reader, and she wanted to know what it was all about. And she got talking to some Jehovah's Witnesses during that period, and spent some time talking to them. And then, One of the children was born profoundly deaf, very deaf indeed. And the Jehovah's Witnesses said to her, that has happened because of your sinfulness. Now that is an example, isn't it, of cause and effect in the observable world. We see something bad happening, it must be because you have done this. And she said one of the best things that happened to her was that in her regular Bible reading, a few days later, she turned to John 9 and said, and read this, as he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus. But it happened so that the work of God might be displayed in this life. There is not cause and effect in an observable way in this universe. That's not right. Some people operate as though it is. And the way that the method that he uses in this book is to say, as it were, yes, but. He says, yes, this looks like there's meaning there, but there isn't meaning there. This is useful to do, but really it's not useful to do. This is a good thing, but really it'll turn out badly in the end. All the time, you'll read something and it'll be a positive statement about life. Two chapters later, you'll find a statement that completely knocks it down, turns it on its head. You see, he's not denying that there's any order in the universe we can observe, simply that it's confused. We see one thing that looks as though it's meaningful. We see another thing which appears to contradict it. Now look at some examples of this. There are many of them in this book. Look at work, for instance. We've already partly looked at this. Chapter 2, verse 10. Chapter 2, verse 10. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work. And this was the reward for all my labor. In other words, I enjoyed my work when I was doing it. It was worth doing. It was enjoyable. Yet, but, verse 11, when I stood back, it seemed like a complete waste of time. What had I accomplished? Everything. What had I accomplished? Similarly, look at life, what he has to say about life in general. Read chapter 9. Turn over to chapter 9 with me, please. Verse 4. This is a great one, because this does it in stages. Anyone who's among the living has hope. Life is a hopeful thing. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. Well, at least it's a bit hopeful. Verse 5, for the living know that they'll die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward. All the hopefulness there is in life is that you can see that you're going to die, and the dead person can't see that. It's really negative, isn't it? Okay? Do you see how he does it? He says, life is good, but, not that good. Look at chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. And this is very negative. I saw the tears of the oppressed. They have no comforter. Power is on the side of their oppressors. It's a familiar scene, isn't it? And they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who is still alive, better off dead, as it were, but better than both is he who's not yet been. Better not to have seen it at all because of how dreadful it is. That's the other end of the spectrum, isn't it? And life is like that, isn't it? Sometimes we do think that. Sometimes we think, is it really a good thing to have children in this world? To bring them in here? It's horrible. And yet it's good. It's got good and bad, hasn't it? Yes, but. Look at wisdom. We already looked at this. We already looked at chapter 2. Look at chapter 8, verse 1. Here's a positive one. Who is like the wise man? Who knows the explanation of things? Wisdom brightens a man's face. It is good for a person to be wise. And yet we'll find out later on that he says it's not good for a person to be wise. What's the point? Because exactly the same thing happens to the wise as to the fool. Now, it's difficult to say that there is a key verse in this book, and there may well not be, but if there is, I think it's chapter 8, verse 17. This is his verdict on wisdom. When I applied my mind to know wisdom and to observe man's labor on earth, again, he's looking at the things that are done in the world, his eyes not seeing sleep day or night, then I saw all that God has done. And he brings in God's activity. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. That is, looking at the observable world, you cannot understand what's going on. Despite all his efforts to search it out, man cannot discover his meaning. Even if a wise man claims he knows, he cannot really comprehend it. You see, the point is that even the wise one, even the godly one, cannot see the meaning in the here and now. It doesn't work out. Now, remember my comment about my friend who said that the world fitted together when you became a Christian. Well, that's true, but the only reason it fits together is that you've got information from outside. And you've got information about the outside. If you just look at what you can see, it is meaningless. And that is the point of this book. Hence his use of Solomon, you see. I don't think it is Solomon that's the author. I think it's somebody who's taking, as it were, the mantle of Solomon and saying, I come from the stable of the wise person. And my view, as a genuinely godly, wise man, is that observable life is meaningless. Really. You can't find ultimate meaning by observation. And you see, there's another way in the way he talks that bears this out, I think. He uses these two phrases. He says, I saw, or I see, or I looked. And then he uses another set of phrases which are all to do with, I know. I see on the one hand, I know on the other hand. Let me give you an example. 7:15. In this meaningless life of mine, I have seen both of these, a righteous man perishing in his righteousness and a wicked man living long in his wickedness. Seems meaningless, doesn't he? Doesn't it? That's what he sees. Look at an example of an I know verse. Look at chapter 8, verse 12. Although a wicked man commits 100 crimes and still lives a long time, I know that it will go better with God-fearing men who are reverent before God. Yet because the wicked do not fear God, it will not go well with them, and their days will not lengthen like a shadow. So on one hand he says, everything I see points to meaningless, but I know that it isn't meaningless. I know that it is worth being wise. I know that it will go well with the righteous in the end. It's just that I can't see it. And do you see the point? On one hand, he sees meaningless. On the other hand, he knows that there's meaning. But it's important to take the meaninglessness on board. Now, I want then to point out some of the ways in which this book might apply to us. To anyone who either in theory or in practice lives as though life only consisted in what they can see. Those are the people this book is primarily for. Now that could be the atheist, couldn't it? It could be somebody who says, this is a closed universe, there is no God out there. All the meaning I have to find must be in here. And to that person, the preacher says, no chance, it's meaningless, you'll never find it. Now we'll look at some of the ways that can be done and how that can be useful evangelistically later on this afternoon. But it can also be somebody who has got God in the framework. Somebody who is a Christian. Now, we don't imagine that we do think like that. We don't imagine that we think like that. But there are some ways in which we do think like that. Let me give you some examples. One of them is when tragedy happens to us. If it happens to ourselves, what is the first thing that people say? Christians say when something dreadful happens, a disaster, to them? Right. Why has God done this to me? Any of you who've worked in hospital or anything like that will know that also people who are not Christians say that too. Why has God done this to me? And some of us take it further and we say, well, God, unless you show me why, unless I can perceive that there is a reason behind this, I will get shirty with you. And I will hold it against you even. And some people do. Christians even hold against God the things that have happened to them way back in their lives, and it changes the rest of their life. Or we see tragedy happening to others. Some friends of ours, younger than us, recently, within the last couple of years, one of them became very seriously ill and is still very seriously ill. And this is the husband of the couple, and the wife of the couple said to me, my parents, who are Christians, say, well, God has a purpose in it. God has a purpose in it. She said, I know that's true, but I'm sick of hearing that. Because I can't see what the purpose is. I don't see it. See, that's exactly what Job's comforters do, isn't it? Or non-comforters. They come along. You know the story of Job's comforters? He gets suddenly hit by disaster. They come along and they say effectively, this must be something which is to do with something you've done. There's a tight cause and effect working within the universe. That's the way it works. And that's wrong. They're wrong. The danger is when all we ever say to people who are suffering is, well, look, God has a purpose in it. It puts a lot of pressure on them to recognize the purpose, to find out what the meaning is. We'd rather have them saying, oh, God is teaching me this through whatever's happening, than them saying, I feel dreadful, this is awful. It puts a great burden on the person who's always being told what the purpose is to find the purpose. And the answer that the teacher gives is that you may not be able to find the purpose. Things may happen to you during your life which you may not see the reason for at the time or ever during your life. Now, obviously, there are things that you can learn from the things that happen to you. Suffering produces patience and that kind of thing. But in terms of seeing what God is accomplishing, there may be no answer. And if all we ever do is reassure people that yes, there's a purpose, yes, there's a purpose, they do need to know that, incidentally. It's not that they don't need to know that. But if that's all they ever get from us, then the pressure is on them to find the purpose, the answer. And what we might better be doing is just sitting there, sympathizing. Interestingly, that's what Job's comforters do to start off with. They wander up to him, sitting on his heap, suffering. And they are dumbfounded, and they say nothing for a long time. Pity they said anything, really, for his sake. It would have been better for him if they hadn't. Sometimes, that's the human element in all this. It's all very well knowing the big picture, knowing that God has an ultimate purpose, but the human experience is that it's meaningless. And if we are always urging people the big picture without the humanity, it can be very cruel, because it can just put them under pressure. You see, we expect things often to declare their meaning now, or if not now, in the near future. And if we do that, we're ignoring the message of this book, which is that as far as you can see, many things will appear completely futile, of no worth whatsoever. Now, Therefore, this is a depressing book when you read it. It is genuinely depressing sometimes. We'll be looking at chapter 12 tomorrow. I spent a number of hours in chapter 12 earlier in the week and came out very depressed indeed. Anyway, we'll have more of that tomorrow. It's not a depressing chapter. And I want to say that though much of the content of this book is depressing, it is not depressing in purpose. And you Romans people ought to know that. Because if you turn to Romans chapter 8, you'll see once again the purpose of God in futility. Chapter 8, verse 18. I consider the present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. The creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, futility, meaninglessness, same word, vanity. Not by its own choice. It didn't happen by accident. It didn't happen because it wanted to, but by the will of the one who subjected it. God did it. God has made it like that. In hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. You see, this message of meaninglessness is ultimately a hopeful one, because it will make us look for answers beyond the created order that we can see and touch. And if you, when reading this book, think to yourself, well, it seems to me from this book that God is a bit hard and impersonal and uncaring out there, look at the focus of the purpose of the futility in Romans 8. It is people-centered. Did you see that? The creation will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. It's not so much that the creation is waiting to be liberated into its own freedom. The creation is waiting to be liberated into human freedom. It's human-centered, this hopeful frustration of things. So as we go through this book, and as we look in subsequent talks at some of the detail of the book and how exactly he brings his arguments out, just remember that it's a hopeful book. Its ultimate purpose is massively hopeful. But we do need to take the meaninglessness seriously. We won't find meaning in the here and now. And what this writer is almost certainly writing for, his primary point, is for those who think that meaning is to be found in the here and now, whoever they are, but supremely the wise person who thinks that meaning can be found in the here and now, that it can't. That's the real central message of this book. Now, folks, has anybody got any questions? I don't know if it's appropriate for people to ask any questions. I've said all I want to say about this time. There are some questions that you can go away and work on now, if you'd like to. But does anybody want to make any comments or ask any questions at this point? Yes.
Can I ask about the use of the word wise in the book?
Yes.
Is he talking about the wise Christian or the wise atheist or both?
Well, it could be both, but I think his primary thrust is towards those who would call themselves believers at the time, but who have squeezed wisdom into, rather than proverbial sayings about the way things tend to happen, hard rules about if you do this, then this will happen. So I think it's primarily geared at, I think his primary audience is the people of God and the people of God within the people of God who think that everything works out in the here and now. However, it obviously speaks to anybody who thinks they know what's going on. So I think the answer is it speaks to everybody. But his primary push is towards the theologian, if you like, who thinks that he has cause and effect sorted out in this world. Okay. Any others? Yes.
Would you say that argument is more philosophical than trying to actually
build a coherent picture of exactly what's what, and actually box
yeah. it. Yes. The question is, do you think it's a sort of coherent argument towards building this argument of the way things are, or is it just bits and pieces? Somebody described this book as guerrilla warfare. You know, he has a bash here and then a bash there, and he has a bash at everything in the end. And it's own, part of the difficulty of reading the book is that it comes in little bits. And so, to a degree, to get the message of the book, you have to pick out the themes and see how he works with the themes. But yes, I think the answer is it's not a coherent argument. It's having a shot at this person or that person or this situation or that situation. Yeah. Yeah, Tony.
You said that wisdom is primarily now-centred in its...
Yes.
And ecclesiastical is now-centred living.
Yes, life. Yes.
It's only now-centred, is it, in terms of the future judgment that's going to happen? So it ends yes. with judgment.
Yes.
So is it now-centred also future-centred? And because it's future-centred, it's
right.
at the application of now-centred.
The answer, for the tape, the question is the book primarily now-centred or is it future-centred? I think the answer to that is, it focuses on the now because life has to be lived in the now. So, and wisdom all does that, and it pays scant attention to, or relatively little attention to, the things that we tend to pay lots of attention to. But that is because life has to be lived in the now. And what it's urging is godliness in behaviour now. However, what it comes up with all the time, and what this book comes up with all the time, is that life only has meaning now because of the future, and particularly because God will judge everything. That is the thing that gives meaning to the now. So it's focused on life, living life now, but ultimately the answers to life now are only to be found in the future that you can't see and can't experience now. Yeah.
Another time scale question. I know yep. it was a bit tricky. You say that we as Christians now know things that weren't known when
yes.
it was written.
Yes.
Set into that context, do you see the verse in Romans 8, i.e. the glorious freedom,
yes.
as a future event on judgment or a continuing process that as our minds as Christians are continually renewed,
right.
that we know more and more and become freer and freer, right. as it were.
I think he's talking primarily about a future event there. He talks about the whole created order groaning. It's all chaotic and disordered, and that one day it will not be like that anymore. It'll be free. I think there's a degree to which the Christian now, in understanding the way the world works, that's the sense in which the world does begin to fit together. But it's only because we know about the future and we have information from outside what is now observable that we can begin to piece together why things are the way they are now. The danger is, you see, with Christians that because we're beginning to piece together why things are the way they are now, that we go all the way and say, well, we can sort of see why everything is the way it is now. And particularly that applies to individual experience. So we look at individual suffering and we say, well, that must be to teach this person dot, 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 dot. And it might not be. Who knows? Do you see what I mean? We can over sort out the here and now because of what we know about the future in a way that isn't really legitimate. And I think particularly when it applies to different people's personal experience, we can do that. We understand the broad drift of things and why, you know, we understand broadly why the creation is groaning and why things look futile, but we don't understand why this person is suffering now. We do not understand that.